Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Last week we concluded that samadhi admits of the cognitive effort necessary for the internalization of right view in samadhi, that is, in jhana. Samadhi is the most immediate source of knowledge and vision, and the content of knowledge and vision depends on right view. This is all supported by what the early discourses clearly tell us. However, last week we stopped short of clarifying how this is possible, given the cognitive complexity of right view and the mental stillness of samadhi. Shulman, who has studied this question most carefully, views the practice of satipatthana as one in which philosophy is internalized to become perception, in which right view becomes woven into the very structure of our perception as an active way of seeing. This is how we come to see through the eyes of the Buddha. This is a perspective that directly integrates Dhamma and liberating knowledge. However, only in samadhi will phenomena be fully penetrated and internalized. The Buddha gives us a hint of how this works in the following passage. Just as an archer or an archer's apprentice undergoes training on a straw man or a heap of clay, and then at a later time becomes a long-distance shooter, a sharpshooter, one who splits a great body, so too, secluded from sensual pleasures, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the first jhana. He considers whatever phenomena exist there pertaining to form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness as impermanent, suffering, an illness, a boil, a dart, misery, affliction, alien, disintegrating, empty, and non-self. And so on for the other jhanas and for the higher attainments, the so-called jhanas 5 through 8. Again, as we saw in a number of passages last week, he clearly tells us that we should bring elements of right view, in this case, the aggregates, into jhana, in fact, into all levels of jhana. What I want to focus on is how he prefaces this account with the description of an archer's training. An archer begins his training with a simple task of shooting at straw and clay targets, which certainly, if he's like the rest of us, will require at that very early point a great deal of effort and produce poor results. However, with further training, he will have gained facility in his weapon. He will be a sharpshooter. At that later point, he will hit difficult moving targets at a great distance, and he will do that, if he's like the rest of us, with ease. He will require little effort and produce exemplary results. The main point here is that with familiarity, practice, and training, the same task will require less effort, both physical and mental. This is a natural observation we can make in virtually any aspect of our lives in which we learn to do something and then learn to do it better. For a more cognitively laden task, the point in a nutshell is that familiarity and habit reduce the cognitive effort needed for the same conceptual content. Eventually, to a manageable level, or even to a level we would be inclined to call effortless. At one time, a particular teaching of right view may be very difficult to wrap our minds around. A year or two later, it might call for a mere gesture of mind. For instance, recall how difficult driving a motor vehicle was at first. That is, how many complex variables you needed to keep track of, from the assessment of possible trajectories of many moving objects, including your own vehicle, to the many decisions required every minute that were made annoyingly slowly from the perspective of the driver behind you. Now, however, you are able to drive down the freeway, ready to respond to any contingency in a heartbeat, more or less successfully, even while you are at once singing along with the radio, drinking a Starbucks, and replaying a football game in your head, barely conscious of the steering wheel under your fingers. Familiarity and habit have intervened to make the same task much less cognitively laden. Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, provides many examples of the human expert's capacity in a variety of fields for reliably assessing enormously complex content in the blink of an eye, as hunch or as intuition, with no idea how they do it. Basketball players that have court sense, generals who have the power of a glance in their technical planning, bird watchers who see the slightest movement in a tree, art dealers who find something just not right about some supposedly rare artifact. Familiarity and habit make these complex tasks cognitively a breeze, or simply a matter of intuition. The capacity for processing complex conceptual content with the slightest gesture of the mind is often attained through focused training. Consider the musician. Beginning with some basic theory, she develops musical sensitivities through years of practice and training guided by instruction and tradition. Never having undergone such training, I tend to picture such people endlessly practicing scales to the annoyance of neighbors and pets. The upshot with time is that her experience of music becomes highly refined and sensitive, and no longer requires any thought or analysis whatever. That her perception and production becomes intuitive rather than conceptual, in her fingers, and quite spontaneous, completely integrated into her perception and production. This commonplace kind of learning process is also in play as we train to see our experiential worlds in accordance with right view, to see through the Buddha's eyes. We begin with study. We have to learn a concept like suffering, dukkha, as something we can recognize and experience. We're told it arises with sickness, with old age, with separation from what we love and from proximity to what we hate, and that its origin is craving. We put our book down and think about it real hard, read a bit more, think a bit more. Then we take our suffering onto the cushion, much as a musician picks up the cello. We begin to discover what suffering looks like in our experiential world, generalize the concept to additional factors, and become alarmed to discover the ubiquity and depth of our suffering, even in situations where we once thought we were having fun. Through continued and repeated contemplation, these factors become increasingly familiar parts of the fabric of our experience and less cognitively laden. Eventually, we require virtually no effort to perceive or to respond to what began as extremely complex conceptual content. We begin to see with crystal clarity that suffering is always accompanied by craving, a sense that something in the experiential situation demands change, and we learn to see suffering as the shadow of craving, always accompanying craving, but disappearing as soon as craving disappears. The point is that internalization of complex conceptual content requires samadhi, just as internalization of musical skill requires deep and wholehearted immersion for long hours in the experience of melodies, harmonies, and rhythms. On the other hand, samadhi can accommodate only a small cognitive effort without spinning into busy mind. In the higher jhanas in particular, even less cognitive effort. The cognitive effort comes from satipatthana, such as investigation of phenomena on the basis of right view. Note that satipatthana is referred to as samadhi nimitta in many texts, indicating that the topics of satipatthana continue in samadhi. In other words, vipassana is the cognitive effort we bring into samadhi. This is a spiraling practice in which we have some choice in how much cognitive effort we want to undertake during a particular sit, which can vary through choice of object, or what depth of samadhi we would like to reach in that sit. A more familiar object of given conceptual complexity can be brought more quickly and more deeply into samadhi than a less familiar object. With time, we should be able to bring the same content into deeper jhanas, or else, if we're still scratching our heads about some content, we can spend some time at the desk with a book in one hand and chin on the other until it becomes familiar enough to bring it into the first jhana. We routinely face a choice about balancing effort and depth. Vipassana, introspection, and samatha, settling, are terms sometimes used in the early Buddhist texts for these contrasting qualities in the meditator's toolkit. As a topic becomes more familiar, it can be carried deeper into samadhi. This is where vipassana and samatha are evenly balanced. The role of the first jhana is particularly notable because it still permits thought and deliberation, vitakka vichara, factors missing in the second, third, and fourth jhanas. Yet it is included in the stillness of samadhi. In fact, the first jhana is discursive in nature. Thought and evaluation are the verbal formation when it breaks into speech. The first jhana therefore provides a kind of workshop in which contemplation at one's desk turns into concentrated effort, while still permitting a degree of reasoning and reflection, though in a highly purposeful and controlled form, focused on the topic of examination, where the possibility of a significant cognitive effort is still supported. The main question for many listeners at this point is whether it's possible to bring any cognitive effort into the higher jhanas at all. Many meditators insist that it's impossible or that they must leave jhana in order to perform any cognitive effort. After all, thought and deliberation are no longer possible in the second jhana and beyond. However, the early texts seem to indicate otherwise. For instance, the Buddha praises Sariputta for his talents for examination of these topics in all jhanas. Whatever qualities there are in the first jhana, he ferrets them out one by one. Known to him they remain, known to him they subside. He then makes exactly the same statement, but with regard to the second jhana, third jhana, and fourth jhana. So, what is the nature of this cognitive effort that is still able to persist in this way? Recall the clear mountain lake of last week, a simile for samadhi, in which a man with good eyesight standing on the bank could see shells, gravel, and pebbles, and also shoals of fish swimming about and resting. My own experience is that in the higher jhanas, we examine phenomena, but it is more like sitting with them than thinking about them. They sit there, seeming suspended, unmoving in space. For instance, suffering with craving right alongside, crystal clear. Sometimes a small gesture of the mind moves from one to another object. At the point that this seems too much like thinking, some would object that we have left jhana. This is a valid perspective, but another is that a thoughtful voice has intruded momentarily into jhana. For instance, we need not lose our established residence in a particular jhana. The momentum of our samadhi pops us right back as soon as the thoughtful voice has made its point. The process within the parameters of samadhi represents a particularly intense, penetrating, sustained, personal, and potentially transformative engagement with right view, something like intense study, but going beyond the limits of normal human perception. In this way, we familiarize ourselves with and habituate the Buddha's way of seeing and finally completely internalize it, make it our own. This is a process that integrates experience, right view, mindfulness, and samadhi to produce knowledge and vision of how things are and bring us closer to awakening.